Chapter 20. Of course you would think so. "I recognize you," the taxi driver said. "You must be mistaken," I told him. Just as foreigners often thought that many Chinese looked alike, Chinese were in the habit of confusing one Westerner for another. "No," he insisted, "I have picked you up before." The driver held up three fingers, saying that it was his third time running into me. When he named the shampoo factory as one previous destination, I figured that he had me pegged. I had been picked up in both Guangzhou and Shantou by taxi drivers who told me that it was their second time running into me, but this was my first triple. Finding it quite a coincidence, I mentioned it to some Chinese friends who were visibly put off by it, offended even. It didn't matter if you ran into the same people all the time, and I did. You weren't supposed to intimate that China was small or quaint. China could not be anything but enormous. It might be a small world, but the Middle Kingdom was supposed to be unknowably large, and the Chinese took great pride in their numbers. It was interesting how foreign economists doubted nearly every single statistic produced by the Chinese government, and yet no one ever challenged the population figures directly. It was a data point left out of discussion, as if it were a strict taboo. The longer I lived in China, though, the smaller it seemed, and the more I had to wonder whether the government's reported population figures weren't plumped up a bit. If it had been done only by accident, you could at least imagine how it might have occurred. The administrator of some small district was asked to count heads. When he reported his final figure to superiors, they came back and suggested that a margin of error be added. There were, after all, migrant laborers all across the country who arrived and worked without authorization. Their numbers were probably added in many districts without ever being subtracted in another location. And then there were other unknowns, like the homeless and those reported millions said still to be living in caves. And of course, under China's one-child policy, many families failed to report childbirths. Officials had to compensate for all sorts of factors. After the estimated figure was tallied and passed up to the county level, it was adjusted upwards again, for similar reasons, just to be on the safe side. And then it happened again at the provincial and national levels. At each stage, some official in charge thought it prudent to add to the final figure. This was China, after all. No one would ever doubt a larger figure, naturally. China had a motive, of course, for inflating its population statistic. For hundreds of years, the government has been selling the promise of a large consumer market to foreign investors. Conservative estimates helped no cause, and in China, political concerns always took precedence over the truth. The best part about census estimates, however, was not what happened inside China, but what went on abroad. In just about any year, no matter what figure the government reported, financial analysts, journalists, and other researchers were all willing to stake their professional reputation on the officially reported figure being on the low side. "China itself doesn't know how many Chinese there are," they would say. When China was claiming that it officially had a population of 1.3 billion, foreigners who had done the research came back with a figure rounded up to 1.5 billion. And these people were never criticized or asked to produce their methodology, in part because there were too many who wanted to believe a higher number. Who needed any friend of China when you had these sort of enablers around? Westerners who visited China for the first time had no problem coming away with the impression that China was enormous. They popped into cities like Shanghai, Beijing, or Guangzhou, and they imagined a similar urban density cast over a landmass the size of the United States. They guessed that China was uniformly populous without stepping away from these coastal, dense urban areas. They did not understand how the interior of China was unlivable, that mountainous regions and other geographic barriers did not lend themselves to agriculture or even residential development. They also failed to take into account cultural differences in urban planning. Chinese do not have the same desire for elbow room, but instead have a preference for renao, the hustle and bustle associated with urban living. American urban planning was characterized by suburban sprawl. One neighborhood blended into another. In China, where they built with density in mind, you could drive from downtown Shanghai and within half an hour find yourself amid open fields with few signs of actual life. Even in the Chinese countryside, villagers preferred to live in relatively tight quarters, with one residence jammed up against the other. Foreigners who have written on China tend toward Polo-esque hyperbole, talking up the size of anything, oh, the scale, and relying on bloated Chinese government statistics as a means of eliciting an emotional response from reading audiences. related to population figures specifically, they have been inclined towards language commonly reserved for astrophysicists attempting to describe the size of the Milky Way. Their intent has been to instill a sense of grandeur and awe. Why these observers did not report the same on India, a country that visually appeared more crowded, was curious. China was supposed to be unimaginably big, but for those who lived in China for longer periods, the place shrank over time. For me, the phenomenon was not only related to taxi drivers, I also bumped into people, other Westerners especially, that I knew in airports, restaurants, on trains, and on the streets. Part of it was perception. Foreigners who were on the ground tended to know of one another. Their communities were more tight-knit, and they were more visible. The Chinese who lived in China, at least, those who held positions in government and industry, were also more likely to know one another. The perception of China as a small place had something to do with demographics. There were many who had very little, and then there were the principal players in the economy. China could seem at times like Ben-Hur, the 1950s Hollywood epic production. There was literally a cast of thousands, but only a small handful got billing. Shantou was a city of a supposed 5 million people, which was the number of people that lived in Philadelphia, San Francisco, or Washington, D.C., and yet all of the foreigners who stayed in Shantou turned up at one of only 3 hotels in the city. And so it was, perhaps, not all that surprising that I would come down to the lobby one morning and see a group of Westerners and think that they actually might be fairly important persons. Business travelers tended to arrive solo or in pairs. This was a group of about 10, and as they were hardly ever tourists in this eastern part of the province, I asked a front desk clerk who they were. "Darts players," he said, "from England." "Darts players from England? How random," I thought. They stood near a large potted plant in the center of the lobby. I walked over to them and introduced myself. One of them, a man in a black T-shirt, shook my hand and told me that they had all flown in for a tournament. "It's tonight," he said. "You should definitely come." I was familiar with the arena where they would be playing. It was on the way to the factory from the hotel. I knew little about the game, though, and as an American, I had a hard time imagining that it was any kind of serious sport. What was darts if not a game of chance? The board even looked like a roulette wheel, with its black and red spaces set about a circle. Chalking this up to a learning opportunity, I decided that I would go. That night at the stadium, I sat next to a middle-aged Chinese man who asked if I was with the British team. I told them that I had just come as a spectator, and the doubt on his face made me realize that I was the only foreigner in the stands. "Are you with the event?" I asked him. "No," he said, "I am a factory." That was how factory owners said it, "Washigongchan." They did not run a factory or own a factory, they were the factory. He admitted not knowing much about darts, but his factory was a supplier of sporting goods, and he supplied a product to a trading company that sold darts. He was a smaller player in the world of export manufacturing, he said, and like many manufacturers, he had some kind of idea that this was a chance to develop more products for the domestic economy. Manufacturers in many sectors were focused on exports, while they secretly hoped for domestic demand to catch on. You saw this in many unusual places. For example, in an area where there was a large concentration of factories making Christmas decorations, you found festive displays in the hotels nearby. It didn't matter what the product was. If it worked outside China, manufacturers wanted to make a go of it in China as well. It was neither westernization nor modernization. It was simply a matter of business. "The Chinese team is here," the man next to me said. For someone not very interested in the game, he was paying attention. The event had not been set up as an exhibition, but as a match between nationalities. It was the British players against a team of Chinese. It seemed like an unlikely setup given that darts was a popular sport in England and almost non-existent in China. The only time I had ever seen the game played in China was in some expatriate bar, and even then the board and darts were in bad condition. The players started, and I found the rules easy enough to pick up. Players got 3 darts at each turn, and the objective was to reach 501 points as quickly as possible. All of the sections on the board had a different point value from 1 to 20, with spaces inside each section worth double and triple points. In order to get to 501 points as quickly as possible, players focused efforts on a small space within the 20-point wedge that brought triple 20. The players from England turned out to be surprisingly skillful, and one player in particular seemed to surpass them all. He was the man I had met in the lobby earlier that day. His name was Phil Taylor, and while I would not find out about this until later, He was actually the dart-throwing world champion. Taylor's preeminence was suggested by an MC flown in for the event who referred to him by his nickname, The Power, without any hint of irony. The audience watched as Taylor went to the line and threw his first three darts. Each dart went right to the triple 20. It was not just that they landed in this small space, but even the way it was done was impressive. His first dart landed to the left of the tiny space, and the second dart flew straight over to the right side of it. His third dart came in on a slightly higher trajectory, so that its fins could land on top of the darts on either side. It represented an incredible level of skill, and making the performance even more interesting was how he played without any fuss or hesitation. When he finished placing all three darts in the triple 20, he turned around and gave a sheepish grin, as if he could not believe his luck. The crowd clapped, but not too loudly, and not for very long. Taylor's Chinese opponent went to the line, looking less confident. He glanced at his feet to make sure they were not crossing the line, and then made several false starts before finally throwing his darts. Out of three darts, none made it to the triple 20. The crowd applauded politely for him. Taylor was a surprisingly large man, and after lumbering up to the line, he put another three darts into the triple 20, and just as before, he placed one on the left in the minuscule space, another to the right, and he floated the third in from above. It did not take any prior knowledge of darts to understand that he was a virtuoso. Watching his performance, I felt like someone who has no idea about golf, observing Tiger Woods as his introduction to the game. Taylor was an oddity in the world of darts. Throwing a perfect game could be done in nine darts. The nine-dart finish was so rare that the cash prize offered for pulling it off on television was in excess of $500,000. In his career, Taylor had thrown more nine-darters than any other player in history. When Taylor managed to nail another three darts to the triple 20 spot, I must have gasped involuntarily, because the man next to me was clearly bothered. "Our players have not prepared well," he said. It was a strange comment to make, because it seemed to be beside the point. I understood the idea about cheering for your own team, and I understood also about rooting for the underdog. Taylor's performance called for some of those other motivations to be set aside, I thought. "Don't you think he is quite good?" I asked. "Of course you would think so," he chuckled. This display of jingoism made little sense. Taylor was such a remarkable player that ignoring his display of skill was a shame, and anyway, it seemed to be the reason why we were all in the arena. The exhibition was meant to inspire a new generation of players, but somehow it got turned into something else. Chinese had a tremendous respect for achievement, and yet no one showed the least bit of interest. They did not cheer Taylor. Quite the opposite. The stadium was filled with a palpable resentment. They were looking to their local players, and they were hoping for some kind of miracle. Taylor was scoring points, but he was losing the crowd. He must have sensed it, because in the very next round, he missed the triple 20 with all three darts, and by a margin that was too wide to have been a mistake. He was dialing back his game. I found the poor play to be a disappointment, but the crowd did not share my opinion. They perked up and viewed the flub as an opening, a chance for their local player to catch up and beat Taylor. On his next turn at the board, the Chinese player measured his throw carefully, bending his arm at the elbow and flexing it back and forth. He squinted hard and leaned forward more, but under this new sort of pressure, the thought of overtaking the great master, he folded. One of his darts bounced off the board and landed on the floor, causing the audience to let out a collective groan. The referee was about to call the score when Taylor raised his hand in a gesture that signaled a pause. Taylor then walked over to the board and collected all three darts of his opponent, and with both hands, he shoved the darts directly into the triple 20 spot. It was a cringe-worthy gesture. The local team was playing so badly that it needed the sympathy of the team that was trouncing it. The game itself had been turned into a sham now, Taylor's pity making the Chinese side's defeat so much more of an embarrassment, but apparently the crowd saw it in a different light. The referee shouted the score, 180! Hearing this, the announcement of a perfect round, the audience went wild and broke out into uproarious applause. It was far louder than anything we had heard that night, and I was taken aback, lost in bewilderment. It was a fictitious score, so what were they cheering exactly? The local player, as if he had actually scored 180 points? Even if counted on the scoreboard, it was an illegitimate accomplishment. Could it be instead, I wondered, that they were cheering Taylor and his gesture instead? The man next to me laughed, and he looked at me now in an approving way. "You foreigners are all right," he seemed to be saying. If we had not been sitting so close together and in such uncomfortable chairs, I thought that he might have actually hugged me. The man pointed to the board and laughed aloud, and I detected in him and in the crowd a fantastic relief, as if everyone had been saved from some great humiliation. It was important for the game to be won, and it mattered less how the score was achieved. Appearance over substance was a cultural theme in China. It quite likely weighed on the reporting of population statistics. The Chinese had a deep nationalistic need to feel superior in every way possible. Justification was a driving force in China, one that influenced behaviors in the manufacturing sector as well.